All right. Well, let me do this little intro. Too bad we don't have our theme song.
I know.
This can impress you. Input output. Okay, welcome to Input Output. I'm Eli Janney.
And I'm Jeff Sanoff.
Our guest today is a self-described soul music producer-engineer. He started out studying and playing jazz guitar and contemporary classical music in California, but subsequently moved to New York and went on to record and mix some of hip-hop's most influential albums of the 80s and 90s, including Tribe Called Quest, De La Soul, Stetsasonic, The Roots, Run DMC, Erykah Badu, D'Angelo, Indy Ari, and
Michelle Ndegicello.
I can never say that name. Mr. Bob Powers.
Yay! I don't even remember all that stuff.
Did I get all those right?
Yeah.
You know, and the thing is, I was like, should I call it hip hop? I don't know.
You know, it's funny. I get asked, people kind of sit around, we'll be talking about stuff, and then someone kind of timidly will say, Have you ever done any rock? And, you know, it's like I do everything. I happen to be there then, and those records blew up.
Oh, that's what happened, so.
Yeah.
Was Stetsasonic the first one?
Yeah, it's funny. I kind of backed into engineering. I was a working musician most of my life and well into my engineering career. I used to go to the studio and have my amp and guitar in the back of the room and go do club dates on Friday and Saturday nights. At 6 o'clock, everyone knew I had to jet.
Wow, what studio was that? They're like, oh, okay, see ya. Have a good gig.
That was the early days of hip-hop, a Calliope.
Oh.
But out of college, I lucked out. I got a good gig. I was scoring TV a couple months a year for about 6 or 7 years and subsidizing my jazz career. And I ended up getting my master's at that point. So I was playing bad dance records. I got really good at 16th note octaves. That's during the Stayin' Alive years.
Yes.
I started scoring industrials because a friend of mine was a producer. And that.
And by actually, industrial, you don't mean KMFDM.
No. For those of you who don't know, big corporate communication shows that they spend an incredible amount of money on, complete with Vegas-style song and dance stuff.
Wow.
Welcome to the Third Reich.
Yeah, and customized lyrics, you know, for the company. You would do a sound-alike of a big hit, but you'd make the lyrics for Q-Tex or something.
Nice.
Whoops, I gave it away.
That is actually on one of your somewhere. I was going to ask you about Q. What did you do for Q-Tex?
Yeah,
I'm just wondering.
That show, we did three tracks. It's really great to have to do a sound-alike and dissect stuff because you learned more than anything. We did Pointer Sisters, I'm So Excited, and of course, Oberheim DX Drum Machine. It was like exactly out of the box perfect. Olivia Newton-John's Let's Get Physical, which I despised until I had to dissect it. And the guitar parts and stuff on it are really cool, and yet it's a little sparkle blue Boss chorus pedal for the most of it.
Nice.
The other one was really fun. Oh, Dolly Parton's 9 to 5, which the playing on that record is really wonderful. So that was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I did industrials, and I started getting into jingles as well, which is where I wanted to be. In the mid-80s, I was producing stuff at Calliope, but working overnight just because it was the cheapest time. And Chris, the owner, would fall asleep at the console, and the sun would come up at 6 in the morning because it faced east. And I would sort of finish things off. I always asked a lot of questions of engineers because I'd been in studios because of the TV stuff for a long time. And one day, one of the other engineers, a guy who worked for me, took a vacation. And so Chris says, oh, Bob's away for 2 weeks. Would you like to fill in? And it's one of those moments where you go, yeah, I can do that. And that was the first Stetsasonic record.
Wow. So that just fell into your lap. That's pretty awesome.
Doing TV stuff or industrials in 1982, are you talking about? 83?
Yeah.
There was no digital. It was all to tape. So you were working at 15 or 30.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're doing punch-ins and drop-ins, and if it has to sync to some visual thing, then you're dealing with tape machines, three-quarter inch decks that have to lock up.
Lots of
it's
synchronization.
Not what it is today where you can pull out your M-Box and basically do in 2 hours.
A quick time.
Guys, having a quick time on the arrange page. and then, you know, when MIDI came in and it started infiltrating, I guess, late 70s, very early 80s, we saw what was coming. a lot of people at that point, a lot of sort of seasoned studio guys said, oh, that shit's not music.
Yeah.
And they're probably selling insurance now, if they're still around. The records in New York, the early hip-hop records, MIDI was very young then. It was sort of like flip a lot of switches and hope for the best, and if it didn't work, flip some more switches.
And then it also drifted. I
and Chris Irwin, who owned Calliope, was actually a younger guy and really very, very forward technically and just saw a lot of things that other people weren't seeing at that point. The original 512K Macs were out, the little tiny one-piece things. No operating system, no hard drive. You had to boot up off a floppy and then load in the sequencing software and hope that it worked. Synchronization to tape at that point was either done via sync tone or time code, kind of. Our zero spot was 100 millisecond delay. So spot on was you played back time code through 100 millisecond delay. And then if you wanted to slip your overdubs forward or back in the time, you would dial in a different delay and see if that felt good and then print it. If you started two different sequencers, whether they were computer-based or not, within 10 or 15 seconds, they would be off. Everybody's 110 was not the same.
I remember we had one of those Roland hardware, the MC, I want to say
MC5 or something.
Yeah.
I love that
something
band.
Like that.
right?
Not to be confused.
That piece was actually a very advanced piece.
Super
for the
advanced, because then you could scroll through and it played every note. But now it's like it's a joke.
And MIDI interfaces, it was really dodgy at the time. In those days, MIDI was the Wild West. And I have to say, now and throughout, I love it.
I wanted to show you this on my iPad, a 48 track recorder.
And it will play back 48 tracks of audio?
Yeah, and it has effects in it.
Effects. It has a channel strip for each thing.
I'm getting it.
Well, getting in and out, I haven't figured out yet.
Yeah.
But it's just this type of thing where people can spend $550, $500 for this, $50 for the software, and have more power than
SSL in your pocket.
You know, one of my riffs about, to me, the crux of everything that's going on right now, at least for us, is what is the revenue stream for recorded music? All other questions are irrelevant.
Yeah.
One of the reasons for that is, yet again, technology has influenced art. Because everybody can make a record in their living room, not that it's going to be a great record, but because they can do it, it tends to devalue that stuff even when it's done well. And MIDI, to a certain degree, at the beginning, was kind of the same thing. The nice thing is now the stuff's mature enough to the point where if you know what you're doing and you pay attention a little bit, you can make beautiful music.
Right.
This is a paradigm of the age we live in. It doesn't matter how you got there. Do you listen? Is it cool? You know?
Yeah. So you think that's okay then?
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
The revenue stream thing, I'm not so certain about.
Well, you know, it's funny. I was talking about revenue stream. I've gotten a few calls in the spring because, you know, friends of mine's kids now, they're getting into high school.
Don't do it.
And they're like, oh, we really, they're, you know, Eli, he's an audio engineer. He worked in records and blah, blah, blah. And they're like, that's so cool. I want to do that. Can you talk to our son about this? Or he wants to come to New York and tour some studios. I'm like, okay. My first question to you is, how many records have you paid for in the past 5 years?
You know, yet another facet of the whole revenue stream thing is when you have a whole generation of kids who've never paid for music in their lives,
perceived
value is
zero.
You can't really expect them not to look at you like you're from Mars when you suggest that.
Yeah. But it's interesting when you see them in their mind make that connection because, of course, they're thinking ahead like, oh, however much you spent, that's how much money you're going to make.
Well, what they do is they get the benefit of your last 25 years in about 10 seconds. You pose the question, you give the answer. It's like, oh, right, now I know.
Well, have you seen, I don't even know if we should bring this up, but the NPR music.
The two most recent things that have gotten all the controversy, there was one blog, they've let their interns, I'm going to cut you off.
Go ahead, you take it.
Their interns have been able to post on this on their blog, and one of them posted a whole thing that got a huge amount of pushback from people, at least on my Facebook feed, about
it was all over.
How she'd been a music fan, and she was a college music DJ and the whole bit, but she'd only ever bought 15 CDs in her life. You know, it kind of reads a little bit like, but that's the way it is, so... And you can tell she actually does like music, but she just doesn't
get it.
So then David Lowery, I don't know if you're familiar with him at all, but he wrote this, just, it's kind of harsh, but it's also kind of not harsh.
It was good, though. It was good.
It was very, very point by point. Here are all the things that you don't understand about what the impact of what your generation is doing. And, of course, then there's a lot of people saying, oh, David Lowery, you sound like a crusty old man. You don't get the new generation.
I am a crusty old man.
It's like, I'm a crusty old man, but I got bills to pay, you know?
Do you guys speak French?
Un peu.
There's an expression that I love, c'est comme ça, which literally translated means it's like that. Figuratively, it is what it is, you know?
Yeah.
I had a big dinner, friendly argument conversation with a friend of mine from Seattle who's a technologist. Guys, if you hear some whimpering or chains in the background, my dog, my overgrown puppy is
very
here
being
a little bit restless. Anyway, he was of the mind that whether you, the world, or God thinks it's right or it's wrong, if something is digitized going forward, it will, he didn't say free, he said it'll be there for everybody. And I railed against it, and I gave the argument of the poor fruit vendor with the oranges on the cart, and do you really want to steal from this man? He said, it kind of doesn't matter what you or I think. I'm almost of that mind at this point, where conceptually digitization does mean that it's probably going to be available to everybody in one way or another. Honey, lie down.
Especially when they digitize my consciousness. Do you really want to know what's inside?
Yeah, do you think people would go there?
You know, but my argument to that is that, you know, that's a social problem. It's like technology, you're not going to stop, clearly. That will go. But as far as people paying for stuff or feeling like they need to pay for stuff, I think that's more of a social thing where it's kind of like wearing seatbelts or throwing trash at your car window. Like, wearing seatbelts in the 50s was just an absurdity. You know, like, nobody did it and no one even thought about it. And that social mindset did change. It took a long time. But now it's like if you get in a car and you don't buckle your seatbelt, people look at you like you're a little nuts.
I wonder if there's a way to imbue people's consciousness.
Not if you live in Texas. You don't feel that way.
Yeah.
I think that there's like things like Kickstarter, where bands are now starting to finance themselves. Because if they want to take it past a certain point and work with people of, you know, reasonable experience. And who doesn't? At a certain point, if you want to advance your art, you start realizing that there's people that know more about these things than maybe you do. That's a way of self-financing that didn't exist, crowdsourcing the money. And that
which
seems
has
like
been
one,
shockingly it's just successful.
Because 15-year-olds still have some money to spend from their parents or whatever, or they have jobs. So if it doesn't go to buying MP3s, maybe it's going to spending $10 to their favorite band to participate in that way. And that's actually cooler
in
a way.
You're actually right, because it is funny. There's a band, Skeleton Key, who I love, and they went on Kickstarter. They needed to make a new record. They got like $20,000 from their fans. If they had recorded it themselves and released it out there, they probably would not have gotten $20,000 from their fans.
Yeah.
Comment, Bob Power.
No. It's just, I find it interesting. You know, they talk about free markets sort of finding their own water level. And I think that the marketplace and the social marketplace, the social cyberspace, I guess, organically, the most efficient mechanisms tend to grow up on their own. So in a weird way, if traditional record labels have started to lose their relevancy in the way that they once had it, that there are other mechanisms that have kind of grown up that not even by design, but just by evolution, circumvent that whole thing. I think it's fascinating.
Yeah, that is interesting.
As we're talking about this, I'm sitting there thinking, the one part of David Lowery's response to this that struck me as ringing true is the fact that companies like Google and Spotify, they're making money off of all the work that everyone else is doing. It's sort of like the internet as a whole giveth and the internet taketh away.
It is interesting how that money funnel of music has been moved from these record labels, and now it's being moved over to these other corporations like Google and Spotify and stuff like that, where the money's still not going to the artists.
Well, yeah, that's, the streaming model, to me, is a very logical thing. There's no reason we need to own this thing, because this thing is ephemeral. There's no physical thing anymore. The part of that that is depressing is the royalty rates that have been figured out as to be statutory rates.
Right.
In a weird way, I mean, if you sit in the back of the room grumbling, you'll never get anywhere, rather than saying, this is the way the wind's blowing now. What do I do?
Yeah, That's I think that's the important part.
On that tip, it's interesting. De La Soul has been tremendously ahead of the curve in many ways. And when they finally got out of their deal with Tommy Boy, which I don't even know when that was, maybe mid-90s, maybe late-90s, they, at that point, started to make their own records. Mm-hmm. And they've been doing it since then. I don't know what distribution networks they had early on, but they made some really cool records, and they have been. They learned to do it themselves. I think it's a fascinating model. I don't see the guys anymore, but at some point I'd love to talk to them about it. And yet a lot of times when you say, wow, you guys did this, it's really cool, Paz will say, oh, yeah.
So all what right. is the difference between soul and R&B?
I'm glad you asked that. An answer I gave for years, it's the difference between Marvin Gaye's Let's Get It On and I think it was Belle Biv DeVoe, Do Me.
Yeah, that's what I was like. I love that quote.
The lines between modern R&B and modern soul music, I don't like to call it neo-soul because it's really not, neo means after something, modeled after something. What was neo-soul was really soul music filtered through the ears of kids who grew up listening to hip-hop. As with every media and other art form, the boundaries have become very, very blurred, and a mashup is a perfect example to the nth degree. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of hard to say at this point, although what I hear of modern R&B, which I don't listen all that much, purposefully the thesis is kept about 3 inches deep. It's just different. I won't say it's better. You know, soul music to me infers something that's way beyond the literal nature of the words being said or the music being played. Does the music take one to a place beyond the literal experience? The answer to that is also, it depends on who you ask. Nonetheless, that's what we're trying to do. That's what right. we're all trying to do.
So as a producer, that's a very difficult question to grasp because not every artist is capable of doing that on every song.
No, but you try. You know, songs are like children, recordings are like kids. You do your best, you shape them, mold them, and let them be themselves. And then they're out there in the world, and, you know, they will be themselves at that point.
One of the things that sort of struck me listening back to music that you've been associated with, like Erykah Badu and D'Angelo, is the sound of it is more open than I think of a lot of that sort of music being, like the feel of it. I know that programming is involved in making those records, but I don't feel aware of that.
Number one, the reason that the records that I have been involved with are great records are because they're really, really great artists. And it begins and ends there. If it's a great artist and a real artist, someone who does something in a way that hasn't been done before and is really compelling at the same time, and if the record doesn't come out good, it means somebody fucked it up along the way. Those records taught me a lot about how to be not just transparent as a producer, but actually somebody say, what's it really about? I said, it's finding talented people who have something unique and interesting to say and helping them get it on tape. And those records taught me a lot about that. And there was a lot of tug of war back and forth. And I realized then, as well as 15 years on, that that's why these people were artists. That's why these people are great. As far as the feel and programming thing, I didn't program a lot of the stuff on those records, but I do a lot of programming. And it is far from impossible to get a great feel programming. I do it every day, and I can get a lot of different feels going. And there's a gazillion tiny details. It's kind of like good production, good engineering is a combination of 1,000 tiny details that by themselves don't really make that great a difference, yet you add them up and it's like, oh my God, this is great. That's a very interesting point, though, is that the programming is not regular to the point of, my God, this isn't interesting. It took having to recreate loops for hip-hop records for me to understand that. I'm an experienced musician. I've been playing most of my life. I have a couple music degrees. And when I first started trying to make loops to replace things, they just didn't sound right. They had no flavor. And when I really started listening to the loops we were emulating, I realized that the funk is... Honey, sit.
No, he's just inspired by funk.
The funk is because everybody's not hitting at the same time. You know, I fell to the 80s like everybody else did. I tried to sound like Steve Lukather when I played and, you know, used that chorusy guitar sound and had a whammy bar for a minute.
Those were cool again, by the way.
I have a lot of them, but I just try not to use them. And then, you know, through hip-hop, I started to realize that the real funk and the real soul is that everything doesn't really line up.
Yeah.
At first, it was hard to legislate because that was a result of a bunch of people playing. But over time, you sort of get a feel for how that stuff works. And with programming, you know, everybody says, oh, it's how you quantize. You know what? It's not. Velocity is much, much, much more important to getting a good feel out of programming than quantizing is. You know, quantizing, yeah, you don't want it sounding like that. But at the same time, a real active and sort of vital in and out with the that's what gives it the feel. It is, it's the dynamics. It's not necessarily the quantizing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
So back in the day, when I was an intern, I actually met you. There's no reason why you would remember this, but when I was starting out, I started out at Sony Music Studios, and you had just got in your room about a month after I'd started there. And you were one of the nicest people, I think probably the nicest person I encountered my 6 months that I lasted there.
By the way, that's the nicest thing anybody could ever say to me.
No,
I'm serious.
No, I honestly, you, when Justin suggested interviewing, I was like, you know, the thing about Bob that I recall is that he was one of the only people, and certainly on your level of production, that noticed me. And when you're in a big facility like that and as a runner, no one pays attention to you because you're just the guy that gets the coffee. And it's like the guy that says, I remember you got some new guitar. It was like a Gretsch hollow body. And you said, hey, do you like guitar? Check out my new guitar. So, like, when you're working for $5 an hour, that is the kind of thing where you're like, I'm not going to forget that guy. And I want to be like that when I get older. Because I just wanted to tell you that story because I had a very fond memory of it.
You know, on this earth, first and last, we're human beings. And, you know, being successful at something has nothing to do with the quality of the human being you are. End of story. The other thing is I have these funny sort of half tongue-in-cheek Powers Laws of Production that I use when the topics flag at my production classes at NYU. I pull some of them out. I said, let's talk about number 79 through 85. Now, they're neither laws nor are they all mine. And it's funny. Every fifth one is, it always takes longer. And then you have a bunch of others, and then it comes up again. It always takes longer. But one of them is be really nice to the studio personnel. And the people who are getting paid the least, probably you need to be the nicest to, because they're not getting it any other way.
Yeah.
You know, my dad was a television producer, and he was like that. He was real cool like that.
Yeah.
So music.
What about tell the truth and don't be afraid?
You know what? That was sort of I have a maxim for each. My sister is rolling her eyes right now because I have maxims for everything. But that was sort of my maxim for about 10 years.
That's a good one. I like that one.
This 10 years is all about engagement. Engage.
Well, I like that one because I think.
Where did you find that?
You know, there's the internet. It's got
the
stuff
Google.
About you.
You got the there's, Google.
I was looking
You're
up some
there.
Stuff. I'm like, oh, look what he said.
You obviously don't Google yourself quite enough.
So I have two. I got
if
two
only
questions.
We knew.
I'm going home.
Guys, I got to go. I got a bunch of questions for you about tech stuff.
Sure.
Low end. That seems to be one of the most important but difficult things to sort of master.
It's the final frontier for most people.
Yeah. So give us some tips.
I was lucky in that my early engineering experience for other people, I'd done stuff for myself, but my early sort of being a commercial engineer, it was all hip hop just about. And I kind of had to learn to get a handle on low end right away, which is usually the last frontier that engineers conquer. For me, at first, it was always getting the high end right because in the late,
because of the cocaine?
Yeah, right. In the late 80s, with bad transistors and sort of not having enough money for good gear, getting a smooth open top end was always very difficult. Mm-hmm. It's weird because I tend to work very instinctively now as a mixer, and I teach mixing from time to time at NYU, and oddly, it's one of the hardest things for me to teach. Yet, the deal is this. Divide and conquer, and everybody knows the same answer. If there are a bunch of different elements happening below 300 hertz, you need to just scrap half of them. Number one, if they all play together harmoniously and don't shake the room apart, which, as you know, two bass-heavy things, if there's a difference tone, the whole room vibrates. You need to kind of carve out areas for each one of them, and it's nothing new. When I first came up in studios as a player, it was always the bass and the kick drum thing. Engineers would always say, well, you know, you got to give the low bottom to one of them and put the other one on the top of that. a lot of times I find if there's a really massive kind of dubby bass and a kick drum that's down there, you can put the kick sort of in the middle of the thing. You can cut out a little hole in the middle so the dub bass actually extends below the kick mm-hmm. drum and above it, but there's a little hole in there. Proper use of compression also helps to tame low end. We usually think of that in the context of it messes up and takes away the low end. Well, it can also tighten it up, and you can get the impression of the timbre of what the instrument's supposed to be without having all that loose low end, and bass guitar is a perfect example of that.
So yeah. What tools, for instance, do you like in those applications?
Anything that works, you know. My go-to EQ is McDSP Filter Bank, and particularly the Parametric. I find it just does what I need it to do most of the time. I find it very adaptable. You know, a lot of digital EQs, when you're used to analog EQ, you turn a knob or you push somewhere, and you don't exactly hear what mm-hmm. you think you should be hearing. Mm-hmm. With McDSP stuff, what I do is usually what I get. And the other thing about digital EQ is you just have to not be afraid. You have to push it a lot harder than you do analog EQ. Oddly, as well, I always heard this from people, and I said, oh, I never would be able to get there, but I do so much more cutting now than I do boosting, and particularly I master now, too. And mastering, I almost never add any high-end to stuff, maybe a half a dB, unless it's really, really messed up. Many instruments, as well as microphones and transducers in general, have resonant frequencies, and when certain instruments play certain pitches, they bloom. That resonant frequency is probably going to be present throughout the whole program. Unfortunately, if you take too much of that away, you lose the fundamental character of the instrument. So I also used to wait. I said, don't automate your EQs, you know, wait until you really, really need it. You know what? Right now, if stuff is really uneven, I go in and just start moving. I put stuff into touch and I go to work. One of the reasons I have to do that is people don't record with a lot of compression these days. And I never understood this until about 10 years ago. Besides gain in general, compression tends to smooth out tonal anomalies in the different ranges of an instrument just because of the nature of compression. I compress to tape or to dig, and you just have to know what you're doing. But one of the reasons that it's tough to mix these days, and I do end up automating a lot of EQs, is just because people don't compress well to tape.
I've definitely had that.
That was a long answer to a short
question. No. I mean, because okay, so in the low-end thing, when you're working on, particularly when you're programming or composing, do you tend to be one of these guys that uses more than one or three, say, samples on a kick drum? Or are you, like, you find the one you like and you just
To try to get it all from one place, yet... In the old days, you know, with hardware samplers, we often, some of those Tribe Called Quest records, if the kick didn't have enough knock to it, or say, you know, maybe 700 to 2K, I'd take a 421 and just hit it on a desktop and sample that, and it's that kind of clunk, and then put that in behind the kick, and all of a sudden the kick has those elements. It's always better to do that, to try and get it there, rather than to try to EQ into something that actually doesn't really exist, and we all know this. Modern sample libraries and modern sound libraries are pretty much good enough where I don't have to layer a lot of stuff anymore, but back in the day, definitely, it was a big deal.
Sampling, obviously, was crucial to the development of hip-hop, particularly the time period that late 80s when James Brown, Funkadelic, all that sort of classic 70s and 60s stuff was just getting sampled. And for rightly so, some of those artists were like, wait a minute. And labels realized
you
that
there's... You mean the stuff I was doing in cover bands.
Exactly. But theoretically, your cover band's bar is paying a royalty to BMI or ASCAP or whatever.
Right.
It's really going in the mob guy who they sent over to pick up the money's pocket. But the sampling, obviously, then all of a sudden, the lawyers sort of dug in, and for some good reasons and some bad reasons, it totally changed how the process went. What were your thoughts at the time, and what do you feel about it now?
At first, I didn't think twice about it. After a while, all my contracts, especially as a mixer, there's always, and this is something that I made them put in there, is that I am not contributing any musical or sonic material. So it kept me out of lawsuits where everybody would be named in the suit. It's happened to me several times where I've been named in a lawsuit for either samples or authorship issues. So I didn't think really much about it at the time. And to tell you the truth, I mean, it's not my vision, it's other people's. I've never been a big one for using samples of previously recorded stuff. Sometimes if I have a song and it needs it, I'll make a complete drum beat and then sample that and put it back against what's already there. But I never really pull stuff off of records. It just wasn't my way. Hmm.
So how did you get into mastering, or when did that happen? I couldn't find that out on Google, as much as I looked.
It happened, I guess, about 6 or 7 years ago. There are several mastering engineers in town who are world-class, who are friends of mine, and there's mm-hmm. a reason why they're world-class. They're really, really good, and they happen to be wonderful people as well, and help me immeasurably along my way in many ways. There have been a lot of times, though, where my clients have ended up getting treated like shit at that point of the process. You know, say my mix clients. If I was producing, it would be different. I got tired of that. And it's not so much that the mastering houses are inherently evil or bad. It's just the way that pressures of doing business now work out, and pressures of getting things out on deadlines, where things that are on the low end of the totem pole, sometimes you can't get your call returned. And I just got, you know, and that was for my clients. It was not for me. It was also something where I just was fascinated by it. And the same way that I've learned about everything just about in my life, which is being interested in it and then finding out a lot about it. At first I said, oh, you can't do that, man. You know, nobody's like engineers and mixes and producers and masters. And then I thought, you know, fuck that. I can do whatever I want. And it's been fascinating. I've learned a lot of things out of the process that I didn't know to begin with. And in fact, lesson number one, I tell my students, master your own stuff. In 5 minutes, you will become a much, much, much better mixer. Because when you master and you start going for what you need, your mistakes just are so clear. And the biggest one is having one element or more in the track that's tonally out of balance with the rest. And I say tonally, not dynamically. Because then what happens, if the hi-hat's perfect and the rest of the track needs to be opened up, which they usually do, you know, you open up the top on mm-hmm. the track and the hi-hat takes the enamel off your teeth. So that's the one biggest thing that I learned. But anyway, yeah, I just kind of did it for my clients, and it's been a lot of fun. I'm very lucky that my room is very telling and very accurate. I have some real good gear that I only use. There's certain things that just don't really work that well across mixes, but for mastering, they work really well.
For instance?
Particularly the Prism Masalec EQ. Mm-hmm. They're weird EQs that don't work the way that all other EQs work. Mm-hmm. So you turn knobs and expect something to happen, and it doesn't. But the Masalec actually, to me, sounds better on very tight cues and small bandwidth boosts or cuts than it does on broad ones, which is exactly the opposite of most equalizers. Mm-hmm. Plus, though, it's great for carving stuff out. And again, that's the piece that I may end up on 3 of the 4 bands actually cutting and adding half a dB at 12K. I own a couple of pendulum pieces. I have a ES-8, which is sort of a hi-fi Fairchild, but he also makes an analog peak limiter called a PL-2. It's really great for getting stuff nice and hot on the way into the converters without any of the negative artifacts of bad limiting and some forms of digital limiting. You know, I'll be honest, I don't think anybody gets competitively loud now with just staying in the analog domain. Mm-hmm. It doesn't happen. What ends up happening is you use a combination of digital and analog tools.
Yeah, it's funny you say that about digital being the only way to get stuff loud enough. The late, great George Marino was mastering a record that I had mixed, and the producer wanted it just a little bit louder after he'd done his mastering. And so he took it in there, and he just ran it through the L2 software. It wasn't even like the hardware unit. It was just the software. And I was like, that's all you're going to do? I could have done that.
It's really weird.
But you're George Marino, so it's okay.
A lot of the big guys and a lot of the guys I've seen at Sterling still use the L2. And for me, particularly the L1, but to a certain degree the L2, when I want to distort something, that's what I use.
Yeah, the L1.
If I want like an acoustic guitar to sound real crunchy, that's what I use. There are a lot of really good tools out there. I happen to love Ozone. Their suite is a very powerful, cost-effective tool. I find, you know what, there's nothing proprietary. I have no secrets. Ozone's limiters are very musical. I also, you know, I have the Oxford. I have everything. They all have their strengths and they all have their kind of sound. The McDSP ML series happens to be very good. Even the single band one, the ML1, has a much more analog-y, friendly sound, whereas I find the Oxford is very brash and bold and kind of brassy. People say, what do you use on this? Well, I use whatever sounds right. As with mixing, as with recording, sometimes the first thing you pull up is right, and then sometimes you have to go through a few things. I just finished some sessions with Bobby McFerrin, and Larry Campbell, a really lovely, lovely musician, plays anything with strings well.
he's
great.
Awesome.
And a wonderful guy. And he had an acoustic guitar, a resonator guitar like a dobro, a pedal steel, a banjo, and something called, I think, a sitar, which was an 8-string, sort of sounds like a 12-string with no bottom. So I had a bunch of mics in there kind of ready to go. And this is a great example. I thought, oh, wow, on the resonator and the banjo, the Royer will sound great. It'll take all that harsh edge mm-hmm. out of those things. And it didn't. It just, so, you know, what was missing was sort of the mid-range grit and the forward nature of the mid-range. And I put a 57, the banjo sounded great with the 57. And the resonator, particularly the slide guitar, sounded really good, too. So
that's an interesting mix there, Larry and
Bobby. It's a fascinating record. Bobby's manager, Linda Goldstein, is a dear friend and a really fine, lovely human being, one of the smartest people I've ever met, and just a creative fountain. And the way she put this record together, I don't know if I'm supposed to talk about it before it's out, but whatever. at this point, the record is called Spirit You All. And it's a bunch of old, what very specifically in the books are called Negro spirituals, but reimagined. And guys, you hit the nail on the head, the combination. Gil Goldstein has done the arrangements, and they're just brilliant. And he is brilliant. And Esperanza Spalding is playing bass, and Larry Campbell, you know, Mr. sort of Levon Helm school, is doing authentic folk, quote-unquote, instruments. Gil is playing both electric piano, and then he played a bunch of accordion and a harmonium. It's really wild. Wow. And I have to say, I didn't expect it to work, and it's beautiful. It's wonderful. It's really, really cool.
Musicians.
Yeah.
They actually matter sometimes.
I just got to tell you a story about Larry. I've done a few sessions with Larry and tell him how awesome he is. He's such a gracious guy. But we were talking. I said, you know, I first encountered you because I got this sample CD. I've always wondered, do you make money off of those things? Because I paid $100 for it. It's, you know, and that's a lot to play for one release. So do you make a lot of money? So I never received anything. That went out of print pretty quickly. And I was like, I don't think that's out of print, actually. And like we went on online and sure enough, it's still available. And then he was not happy about
that. I hope he called somebody.
I guess the thing that reminds me, though, is how much you get so used to your job that you forget that musicians actually... You know, that's like the most important thing. That's what
we
do.
I've never forgotten
that. Well, you've never forgotten that.
No, and also I play a lot on my tracks. I play a lot of guitar, a lot of keyboards, and I generally, you know, my keys now, I really don't do much quantizing. When I do hire players, I get to work with just some astounding musicians, and the last couple of days just with those folks, though, brought it back to a whole different level. You know, Esperanza, she's really sweet. She's cute. She also plays really, really well. It's not just because she's sweet and she's cute that she's making a name. She is up there with, and I've worked jazz and otherwise with some of the best players ever to live. She is up there. Her time feel is, because there were no drums, she was really defining the time and just totally rocking it.
Was it? You worked with Ron Carter on something I saw.
Yeah, there was a track called Quest, called Excursions that he was on. And then I hired him. I hate to use that word with him. I begged him. And he played on an Erykah Badu song called Next Lifetime.
Yeah. How's I'm just curious.
Ron's great. You know, it's funny. We're all quaking in our boots. But then I realized, like any good musician, I learned very quickly about Ron. If you're professional, you move things along and you give them the right materials to do a good job. That's the problem. If you call a player like that and you come in and he goes, well, what's the song? And well, here it is. Do you have a chart? No. You know, stuff like that. It's not good. But if you have a well-prepared chart and you talk to somebody like a musician, guys sit down, they're professionals, they do their job, and they leave happy.
Yeah.
And that was a great lesson with Ron, a real super pro.
Cool.
But we were still quaking.
Singers, especially in soul music, the vocalist is everything, and the vocal production, I think, again, going back to Erykah Badu and D'Angelo, I mean, the D'Angelo stuff is just so insane. I mean, I listen to that and I'm like, how do you come up with that? So how do you come up with that?
Well, I didn't. They did. like I said, you know, you try to find something, somebody with something unique and special to say who says it in a compelling way, and then figure out the best way to get it on tape and make it work. I'm a big comper. I used to sort of legislate every eyelash in the 70s and 80s, you know, no, let's stop, let's punch that word, let's do this. I don't do that because you don't get a good flow that way. Some people do it and do very well at it. It's not my way. I'm a big comper. And I've said for years, great producers are always really great compers. And digital has made it so lovely that you can take a bunch of takes. One of the things, though, that I do with singers now is I tell them, I said, listen, when you get it to the place where it's what you meant to do, you tell me, and then, you know, if you need direction, I will give it to you. And that's always great. And it's weird. You guys have done this a long time. Generally, takes one, two, and three, or thereabouts, the voice is just getting warm, and you can't even use pieces of that a lot of times in the comp because the voice sounds so different.
Yeah.
And then takes maybe four through eight or nine are really what end up making the meat of the record. And then if there's a lot of tears and agita, which always means it comes out being a great record, it's take 16 that does it, you know. I work with people who are good, so I try to use what they're good at and nudge them more in that direction rather than trying to make them into something else.
How do you know when to stop? Vocal production can get so elaborate and so...
I don't like the worst thing when I hear, and I can hear it real well, when someone's voice starts to get tired, I go a little further and then I stop. And if I got what I need that day, great. If we need to patch stuff, then we come back and do it. I really hate just pushing people and pushing people. And again, a lot of great records have been made that way. That's just not the way I choose to do things. Mm. With a lot of the great records, and particularly Dee and Erykah, they had it all mapped out. You know, my thing was just to help keep it organized and get it down and then find the truth in it and make sure that that truth came out. I also find that most really experienced studio singers and R&B singers have a gazillion backup parts already in their head. And later on, I may think, you know what, we need to not have this one going on at this point because it's just too much information. I did a record with Selena Johnson, who just is an incredible singer. And she, you know, she was a fountain of background parts.
So does having a master's make you a master? And is it something that you both...
Well, you've got, so you did undergraduate in California?
No, I did my undergrad at Webster University in St. Louis, and I have a degree in classical theory and composition. It's weird. I played bad rock guitar by ear before I went to school, and I just didn't know what to do, and it's actually a bachelor in music, and it was really hard, and I knew nothing about classical music or music theory. And, you know, there were all these kids who'd been playing classical piano since they were four. And I just kept saying, they're not any smarter than you. So if you don't do this, it's only because you didn't try hard enough. Mm. So, and I have to say that my musical education has made everything else possible. It has informed everything that I do as an engineer or as a producer, the sort of underpinnings of the way I listen to and take music apart in my mind. It's made everything else possible. I ended up getting my master's at Lone Mountain College, and it's sort of in jazz and production. Those were my jazz years. And yes, it's. I feel very, very fortunate to have that in me, because my understanding, my depth with music, again, has informed me and makes everything else possible. I have no idea how people would do it without that. I just, I don't know.
Yeah. So wait, you got your master's and then you came back to New York?
Yeah.
How old were you when you started working at Calliope?
I was actually in my mid-30s when I started engineering for other people. I'd always done stuff for myself, like little stuff, looked over the shoulders of some really great engineers in San Francisco where I was doing the TV stuff. And I was in my mid-30s. It was really, you know, I kind of backed into my master's the same way I backed into engineering. It just sort of happened.
Huh. So, Bob, given the landscape of the technology now, you have your own room. How much do you end up working outside of that versus how much do you work in your own space? And what technology do you find to be vital to your workflow?
Yeah, what's in your crib?
What's in your kitchen cabinet, man?
Actually don't work out at other studios very much anymore. And like most mixers, because the bulk of my work is mixing and mastering these days, I do almost all my work at my place. People send me stuff often electronically, and you send stuff back. Yeah. That's the way it works now.
Yeah.
5 or 6, maybe 7 years ago, I lose track. I made a firm commitment to becoming a better in-the-box mixer. And I only did it for one reason, because I thought, you know what? You could be better at this. You do this other thing pretty well, but you could be better at this. Little did I know that it was one of the most important commercial and sort of harmonious things, meaning being in harmony with the way things really work now, that I ever did. And the challenges of in-the-box mixing are much greater. You have to work harder to make it sound really good. But it is possible. So I do most of my work in my own place. My room there is odd. It's much of my philosophy of producing records. I tried to find what was really cool about the room and make that work for me. I think people who do expensive build-ins before they live in the place for a year, it's nuts. what I did was I took a powered speaker and an iPod, and I walked around the room and played music in different areas of the room. And in the one that sounded the best, I lucked out, because they're double windows to the street, but I can see the sky from my mixing position, and I wanted that. The facility was an audio post place, so the rooms are all very odd asymmetrical shapes, so that helped.
Is all the mixing then, you don't use a desk or a summing mixer?
I have an O2R 96, which arguably is the world's largest mouse. Or
that's the icon?
I just got it as a utility thing. You know, I had a regular O2R for years back when I had two DA88s, and I just always needed a desk, so I got it. It's a great routing box. I don't use any of the onboard EQ or compression or automation anymore, just because I realized that one of the great advantages to mixing digital, and it is a great, great advantage, is you press a button and you're back to where you were.
Right.
And being able to work on things over longer periods of time and getting away to other things and then coming back, your perspective is so much better. But anyway, so I leave the O2R 96 faders are Unity, and I have stereo pairs, 1 and 2, 3 and 4, 5 and 6. And I send my instrumental groupings out of those stereo pairs. And the reason I started doing that is because originally, and I still do this, if I do mix a record in the studio, I get it 3/4 of the way at my place first. And then it's uncanny. You take it up to normally an SSLJ or a K. You set the pan pots out in stereo pairs, 1, 2, 3, and 4. you start Pro Tools and it sounds exactly the same as it sounded in my studio. And then I pull things out one by one that I need to split out. Hmm. It's a good method of hybrid mixing.
Yeah, we talked about how there's a whole generation of kids who don't know what a recall is, you know, and how, I mean.
They're lucky.
It's true though, but it's like.
It doesn't sound the
like,
same. It doesn't sound the same. Still doesn't sound the same.
Still doesn't sound the same. No, but now it's like word processing. Right. You open it up and boom, you're exactly.
And I love it. I love it. Yeah. Listen, virtual instruments, people don't understand because I did a lot of scoring and a lot of jingles. Virtual instruments were the greatest thing to happen to digital music making since MIDI itself. Mm. To not have to go up and down my rack of 8 or 10 things and go to the multi on one and go to the multi on the next one, go to the multi on the third one. You could have used SysX to do that. Not a good idea, if you guys know. Things used to blow up all the time. You lose all your patches. And being able to press the space bar and having everything come out is huge. Speaking of recall, I do have a 2-bus analog chain that I go through, and I have to say it makes a huge difference. So after I come out of the O2R96 in stereo, my mix chain is the Pendulum ES8 Hi-Fi Fairchild, an API 2500, which is so much bang for the buck. It's a great piece. JML 8200 EQ. Two TubeTech PE1C Pultec copies, sort of.
Right, right.
And then the Maselec mastering EQ, which I tend not to use on mixes. And what I do is I mix and match. I suss out the track. I say, okay, these things are going to sound good on this. And that makes a huge difference. I get the mix sounding really good without it. And then I put the stuff through it and don't do much. And then I A-B what I thought sounded good before. And it's like, oh my God, this sounds so much better. The TubeTechs, just even going through them with no booster cut, it tends to suck a little bit of the lower mids out of things, which is generally not a bad thing in terms of clarity and transparency. Unless, you know, if it's a rock track that I need that there, I don't use it. But it also, the tubes tend to deepen the stereo feel to me. You can hear further back in it than, and I'm not like, if it's tubes, it must be good. That's not me. But I do like the front to rear depth that going through those things helps. One of the things I say about analog compression is not about hi-fi. It's about the sound of a record. It's what we've become conditioned to as hearing the sound of a record. And 1176 on a vocal is a great example. I didn't use them for a long time because it just, I heard the footprint of the piece too much. And then I started to realize, well, wait a minute, this is a record and that sounds like a record. So it's cool.
Well, given the way that technology has changed things, and you seem to be someone who's happily adapted to those changes, are there things that you wish you could bring back from, if you had a time machine and could transport things from the past to the future, what would they be?
The revenue stream. No, I'm sick, guys. You asked. The revenue stream for recorded music.
Yeah.
I give talks about art and technology a lot, and music making and recording music has changed more due to technology than almost any art form out there. From a humanist perspective, it's great. It's democratized yet again, like MIDI did. It's democratized music making. You know, in the old days, you needed a lot of money. You needed to hire a good studio, good engineer, an arranger, all these studio musicians just to make something. So there was a wonderful mystique about it, and exclusivity. Yet, you know, that's kind of cool, but on a human level, I realize that what we're doing now is much cooler because everybody can do it. Everybody has access to it. I'm trying to think if there's anything else I miss about the old days. I got to tell you guys, everything's so much easier now. I do, when I do rock records, I like to track through a 2-inch machine as a pass-through. Rock drums that have never hit tape are very hard to get to sit in a track sometimes. Mm. And they're very spitty. And obviously, tape helps that.
You haven't tried any of the tape emulators?
Yeah, I use them. And in fact, I should have more than I do. But McDSP makes some. And I'm a big fan of the Crane Song Phoenix Suite. I have the Oxford one. And there's a whole bunch of different ones now. And even Stephen Massey's thing is really cool. Oh, it's crunchy, but it's cool crunchy.
Yeah, that is
yeah,
cool.
Yeah. A lot of times if something isn't poking through a track enough, if you put Massey's thing on it and solo it, it really kind of has lo-fied it to almost a frightening degree. But it pokes, you know, brings up the mid-range and like makes it poke through the track in a really nice way. So I'm trying, you know, I should miss something about the old days, but I have these 2 6-foot mix racks that haven't been open in a long time. They used to go back and forth to L.A. all the time. Now, we know that analog effects sound different than digital ones. Fine. That's one issue. That said, doing really complicated effects like taking a delay, distorting it, sending it to a flanger, then sending it to a reverb, stuff like that is so much easier yeah. in digital than it was in analog, and especially for the person who has to do the recall. The other thing, like stuff like feeding a delay back to itself, in the analog realm, it's very tough, even if you're automated, because every pass, the feedback works a little differently, and occasionally it'll get out of control and just start to swallow the track or not feedback enough. Mm. The digital thing is great because it's exactly the same each time. I should miss something more. I miss the fact that I'm not 28 anymore, but, you know, that's the way it works. What should I miss, guys?
Oh, I don't know.
We interviewed Kevin Killen. You mm-hmm. know who he
I
is?
Love Kevin.
Yeah, we talked with him because he was a big proponent of mixing in the box very early on. And, you know, there's this still running argument about in the box versus out of the box. And he was kind of the same way a little bit, where he was like, well, so many things work so much better now.
I think things that people talk about, at least, like Kevin sort of mentioned this as well, is the social elements have changed because of the production styles. Have necessitated a lot more sort of atomization. You're in your own little world. People come to you or they send you tracks. You don't even necessarily...
How many records have you mixed? This is a good question for Bob. Where you never meet the band.
I would say in the last 8 years, maybe 10 to 20% of what I've done. In a weird way, it's better. Because something I ask my clients to do a lot also is, instead of kind of hemming and hawing, I ask people to make lists, because then they become concrete things and you can actually go down the list and fix things mm-hmm. rather than wondering what they meant. And when you do mix long distance, that's what you get. You get a list of things to do. I make lists. And when I take breaks now, when I'm mixing and I come back, if I'm fairly far along, the first pass, I don't stop at all, which is very difficult. And everything that bugs me, I write down on a piece of paper. And then you go down the list. And it's good time management. You get not lost in the morass. Mm. You know, the social element, it's like I've hung out enough in my lifetime, you know.
Well, I guess what I was referring to is more the sort of... random confluence of elements that wouldn't necessarily... Like, Kevin yeah. seems like part of his strategy for working, and I bet you probably do this too, is trying to introduce elements of the unexpected, because there isn't some guitar player, well, you in your case, maybe it would be a singer right down the hall who you can say, hey, you know what would be great is if you sang on this one part here.
Or that instrumentalist saying to you, you know, can you do... I was hearing this kind of like a ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. I have always suffered as a mixer under the assumption that people record what they mean to be there. And in fact, I have often labored for days over elements in mixes that people will come in and say, oh, you know, that's not really important. It's like, why the fuck did you put it down? I'm an optimist, and I tend to feel like people recorded stuff in the fashion that they did because they wanted it to sound that way. The interaction thing is cool. When you do something for a real long time, the line between people being creative collaborators and a pain in the ass becomes a very wiggly, indistinct one, you know.
Tell it like it is.
Too true.
That is awesome. You know, I used to think I wanted to be like Bob when I grew up, and now I really want to be like Bob when I grow up.
Well, thank you, guys. It's been a real pleasure to be here.
And thank you very much.
This is a great conversation without the beer. And I don't even think it could be any better. But thank you again, gentlemen. This has been a delight.
Oh, thank you so much for coming today, Bob Power. Bob Power is a soul producer, as he calls himself. He's worked with some of the greatest names in hip-hop. He's Grammy nominated and...
Multi platinum. But yep. as well as just having been a very humble and...
genuinely nice guy.
Yeah, I mean, it's not too many guys that have worked on so many great records and take almost no credit whatsoever for them, just saying, I was in the room. That's not... how they don't grow them like that anymore.
Well, thank you, Bob Powers, very much. I'm Eli Janney.
And I'm Jeff Sanoff.
And you've been listening to Input Output Podcast. Input Output Podcast is produced by Justin Coletti in association with sonicscoop.com. You can reach us at inputoutputpodcast@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter, Input Output Podcast.
Input Output. Input Output.
Gracias.